17. The Quick Draw Artist, the Yegg, and the Soup Man. During the fall of 1925, White tried to reassure Hoover that he'd gather enough evidence to put away Hale and his accomplices. White sent Hoover a memo reporting that an undercover operative was on Hale's ranch that very moment spying. White was feeling pressure, not just from Hoover. In the short time that White had been on the case, he had seen the lights burning each night around the homes of the Osage, and seen that members of the community wouldn't let their children go into town alone, and seen more and more residents selling their homes and moving to distant states or even other countries like Mexico and Canada. Later, one Osage called it a diaspora. The desperation of the Osage was unmistakable, as was their skepticism toward the investigation. What had the U.S. government done for them? Why did they, unlike other Americans, have to use their own money to fund a Justice Department investigation? Why had nobody been arrested? An Osage chief said, "I made peace with the white man and lay down my arms never to take them up again, and now I and my fellow tribesmen must suffer." White had come to understand that prejudiced and corrupt white citizens would not implicate one of their own in the killing of American Indians, and so he decided to change his strategy. He would try to find a source instead among the most disreputable, dangerous group of Oklahomans, the outlaws of the Osage Hills. Reports from agents and informants like Morrison suggested that several of these desperados had knowledge about the murders. These men might not be any less racist, but because some of them had recently been arrested or convicted of crimes, White would at least hold some leverage over them. The name of one outlaw in particular kept coming up. Dick Gregg, a 23-year-old stick-up man who used to run with the Al Spencer gang and who was now in a Kansas penitentiary serving a 10-year sentence for robbery. Gregg had once told Agent Berger that he knew something about the murders, though he remained coy, insisting that he couldn't betray a confidence. In a report, Agent Berger noted in frustration, "Gregg is 100% criminal and will tell as little as he can." Comstock, the attorney and guardian, knew Gregg's father well and provided legal counsel for the family. Hoover still didn't trust Comstock, but it was Comstock who used his relationship with Gregg's father to help persuade the young outlaw to cooperate with the Bureau. Eventually, White met with Gregg himself. White liked to take mental notes about the criminals he encountered in order to fix them in his memory, a skill honed from his time on the frontier when he could not rely on mugshots or fingerprints. Decades later, when White was asked to describe Gregg, he wrote with remarkable precision, "A very small man, I should say 5'6", and weighed 125 pounds, fair complexion, blue eyes, and light brown hair. A good-looking youngster." Gregg's pretty looks were deceiving, according to a prosecutor who said that he was a cold, cruel, calculating type of criminal who would not hesitate to commit murder. Still, in White's view, Gregg belonged to that category of outlaw who was not inherently bad and who might even have gone places with proper training. Though Gregg was known for his nerve as a stick-up man, he was reluctant to cross Hale. "If word got out," Gregg said, "my life would not be worth a damn." But hoping to shave time off his robbery sentence, he agreed to divulge to White and other agents what he knew. "Sometime in the summer of 1922, he recalled, "the outlaw, Al Spencer, told him that Hale wanted to meet with the gang, and so Spencer, Gregg, and several associates headed to one of Hale's pastures near Fairfax. Hale rode up fiercely on his horse, emerging from the tall prairie grasses. The group convened by the edge of a creek and shared some whiskey. Then Hale asked Spencer to step aside with him, and the two went off to talk. After they returned and the meeting broke up, Spencer relayed their conversation. Hale told Spencer that he'd pay him and his gang at least $2,000 to bump off a couple, an old man and his blanket, meaning an Indian woman. Spencer asked Hale whom he wanted dead. 'Bill Smith and his wife,' he said. Spencer told Hale that he might be cold-blooded, but he wouldn't kill a woman for silver. As he put it, 'That's not my style.' Hale said he hoped that Gregg at least would go through with the plan, but Gregg agreed with Spencer. White thought that Gregg was being on the level, and that his refusal to kill for hire showed him to be an outlaw with some honor. But though Gregg's testimony offered the clearest indication yet that Hale had ordered the murders, it was of limited legal value. After all, the statement was coming from a crook seeking to shorten his sentence, and Spencer, the one person who could corroborate Gregg's testimony, had since been gunned down by a posse of lawmen. The Pawhuska Daily Capital had reported, with $10,000 bonds in one hand and Winchester clutched in the other, famous bandit dies in his boots, while hills which gave him shelter in life are his sepulchre in death. During one of his interrogations, Gregg said that agents should find Curly Johnson, an outlaw who ran with the stick-up man Blackie Thompson. Johnson knows all about the Smith blow-up and will squeal if made to do so, Gregg promised. But Johnson, it turned out, was also rotting underground. Less than a year earlier, he died suddenly. Word was of poisoned alcohol. White's desperate search for a witness soon led him to Henry Grammer, the rodeo star and gun-slinging bootlegger who every year or so seemed to draw down on another man because of a dispute. "Henry Grammer shoots again," one headline put it. Though Grammer and Hale generally moved in different circles, White established that they'd known each other for years from the time when Hale had first appeared in Osage Territory at the turn of the century. In a rodeo contest in 1909, they'd competed with the Osage Cowboys against the Cherokee Cowboys. "Cherokee's no match for the Osage Ropers," declared the Muskogee Times Democrat. By 1925, Hale had shed his past, but there remained a faded photograph from the contest. It showed Hale and Grammer sitting proudly on their horses, holding up coiled ropes. Just before the Smith house blew up, Hale had told friends that he was heading out of town to attend the Fat Stock Show in Fort Worth, Texas. White looked into Hale's alibi and was told that Grammer had gone with him. A witness had overheard Hale talking to Grammer before the murders, murmuring something about being ready for that Indian deal. Like the other potential witnesses against Hale, however, Grammer was dead. On June 14, 1923, 3 months after the Smith's house was demolished, Grammer had been killed when his Cadillac spun out of control and flipped over. The legendary quick-draw artist had bled out on an empty country road. Finally, a yegg, a safecracker, gave White and his team the name of another witness to the bombing plot. Asa Kirby, the gold-toothed outlaw who had been an associate of Grammer's. The yegg said that Kirby was the soup man, the expert in explosives who had designed the bomb. But it turned out that Kirby couldn't testify either. A few weeks after Grammer's fatal car crash, he'd broken into a store in the middle of the night in an attempt to steal a stash of diamonds, only to find that the shopkeeper had been tipped off beforehand and was lying in wait with his 12-gauge shotgun. In an instant, Kirby was blasted into the world beyond. The person who had tipped off the shopkeeper about the robbery, White was hardly surprised to learn, was William K. Hale. By foiling the heist, Hale had reinforced his reputation for upholding law and order. But another outlaw told White that Hale had actually set up the robbery, that he told Kirby about the diamonds and suggested the ideal time to break in. It was evidently a plot within a plot, and White suddenly became suspicious of the litany of dead witnesses. He inquired about Grammer's car accident and was told by people who knew him that they believed his Cadillac steering wheel and brakes had been tampered with. Curly Johnson's widow, meanwhile, was sure that her husband had been murdered, intentionally poisoned by Hale and his henchmen. And when White learned about a potential witness in the Roan murder case, he discovered that this person had been bludgeoned to death. Anyone who could implicate Hale, it seemed, was being eliminated. The yegg said that Hale was taking care of too many people, adding, "I might be taking care of myself." Having failed to locate any living witnesses, White found himself stymied, and Hale seemed aware that agents were on to him. "Hale knows everything," the informant Morrison had told agents, and there were signs that Morrison might be playing his own duplicitous game. Morrison, agents learned, had told a friend that he had all the dope on the murders and had saved Hale's damned neck till now. Hale had begun spreading even more patronage to solidify his power. In a report, Agent Wren wrote that Hale was making all the propaganda he can to favor himself by giving presents, suits of clothes, as well as going on notes, providing loans for different people. Hale was even giving ponies away to young boys. One of the undercover operatives who was playing a Texas cattleman had slowly become close with Hale. They shared stories about the old days cowboying, and the operative accompanied Hale as he inspected his herds of cattle. The operative reported that Hale seemed to be mocking investigators. Hale boasted to him, "I'm too slick and keen to catch cold." White would see Hale on the streets of Fairfax with his bow tie on and his chin up, the incarnation of what White and his brothers and their father before them had spent their lives chasing. He carried himself, White thought, like he owned the world. Sometimes as the strain on White intensified, as each promising lead dead-ended, he would take his rifle and disappear into the countryside. Spotting a duck or some other flying prey, he would take aim and fire until the air was laced with smoke and blood drained into the soil.